I'm wearing like 900 rings today.
I was about to apologize because I actually wrote my notes in paper.
I did too, and it's going to be a struggle.
Okay, we'll try to turn the pages really quietly.
Okay, why did I choose to wear so many rings? Okay, I'm free. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Drawing Blood, our podcast about the histories of science and medicine and technology, art history, and the macabre. I'm Christy Slobogan.
And I'm Emma Merkling.
And today we are in 1940s America, looking at Francis Glessner Lee's Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. And we're thinking in this episode about the history of legal medicine and forensic science, dollhouses, critical play, and art history and its tools of looking, understanding, and analysis.
We're making up for the lack of content notes in the last episode by a whole plethora of them for this episode. We're talking about intimate partner violence. We'll be talking about and showing images of some quite gory scenes and reinterpretations of sudden, unexplained, and violent deaths.
Yeah, definitely content warning for murder throughout, and also visualizations of blood, for sure. Yeah,
and history of racism and police brutality. Yeah, so, trigger warning for cops. Okay, so one of the things I'm really excited about this episode is, in many ways, it feels like the perfect follow-up to episode one of season two. Like, first of all, I have modified my understanding of play, or like, I knew in the last episode that I wasn't quite getting somewhere in my thinking, and I think I found a text when I was prepping for this episode that actually got me there. Okay, that's reason one. I'm excited.
Good.
Reason
sounds
two
good.
Is that of all the episodes we've done, I think that this one sits the most perfectly at the intersection of almost all of my interests. Like,
great
beyond, and perhaps not even including the academic. You know, I mean, like,
great.
My grandma raised me, for better or for worse, watching wildly inappropriate murder stuff on TV when I was growing up. I was obsessed with the Agatha Christie books. I've read every single one, and they were like 80.
I loved Agatha Christie when I was a kid, and then They Were None. That was my, like, first one. And then,
I think, like, I hope we'll get to it because it's maybe slightly secondary, but it's not by coincidence that I mentioned Poirot. You know, we talked about Arthur Conan Doyle in our Marjorie episode in season one, I think.
I forgot about that. We did. Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. And the character of Sherlock Holmes, I think, is quite important for some of the stuff we're going to talk about.
I happen to have that in my notes already, so Fuck you for bringing it up first.
Okay, great. So shall we get started by looking at some images? I've texted you a link.
Okay. I feel like I'm in a like reality show where I'm waiting to see if I've gotten chosen or something. And I'm like opening the... Okay. Americanart.si.edu. Okay.
Scroll all the way down to where it says, go inside the dollhouses.
Oh.
Okay. Now I want you to swipe to the left until you see one that's called living room.
Okay. Go into the living room.
Yes.
This is so cool.
Do you want to describe what you're seeing or what's happening?
Yeah, so it's like a VR room, like a virtual reality room. So I clicked living room and I've now been placed into this kind of chintzy, maybe 1950s living room.
I love the word chintzy.
I love the word. There's a chintz couch. I think that's chintz. A patterned floral couch with some knitting on it and a book to my left. I've been dropped right in front of the coffee table with some books and some questionable Buddha statue. Cigarettes in an ashtray, a green glass banker's lamp, orange curtains, really structured curtains, a grandfather clock, or maybe just a clock on the wall.
There's a
some
cat.
Newspapers.
There's a cat on the couch.
I thought that was a basket of knitting. No, it's got a face. And then if you look over in the corner, there's a matching chintzy armchair with some newspapers, almost like they've been dropped.
Keep swiping till you see the staircase.
So I'm swiping. There's a fireplace. And then when you rotate all the way to the right, there appears to be a doll body that has fallen down the stairs. And so you can really only see, and the stairs are revealed with orange curtains pushed all the way to the right. And so you can really only see her body clad in maybe a nightgown, and you can only see it from the torso up, and she's laying face down on the second stair. And it really took me a second to realize what this was.
And it's funny, you just said something, but you hadn't said it explicitly yet. You said a doll, because we're inside a dollhouse.
Yes.
And this is, in fact, a miniature, even though that's not necessarily, once you've been dropped in this VR set, that's not necessarily, I think, immediately apparent.
Absolutely. Yeah, when you're dropped in, if I didn't have the title right above this saying go inside the dollhouses, I wouldn't necessarily have thought that that was the case. And so the fact that it's miniature makes me kind of reevaluate what all these objects actually are and how they're made, which is really interesting. Like the cat slash ball of yarn makes more sense why that cat is knitted, because it's tiny, tiny. You know what I mean?
Yes. One of the things that's wild is the level of detail, and I think the precision in this scene. And I do want to caveat that, you know, I think an important thing as we go into describing what these doll houses is how you're seeing them now is in some ways the ideal way to see them, as being able to be dropped into this scene as a viewer at eye level with all these objects, almost in this Alice in Wonderland-esque way. However, how these objects actually exist and how they would actually have been experienced is as dollhouses, as miniatures. Unfortunately, we're not in Baltimore, or you are, but I'm not. So we can't look at them together in person. But
okay. Well, so actually one more thing that you're saying now that I know that they are dollhouses, and we just mentioned briefly like the amount of detail that has to go into something that's this miniature, is the detail on the rug that's in front of the fireplace, and you can see the frayed edges on the side of it that makes it once again feel like a chintzy and lived in real room rather than a perfectly constructed dollhouse, which is so cool thinking about like however these are made and however these are constructed.
So it's really interesting that you pick up on that observation, because there's a whole lot of, I don't know if it's myth building or truth, around how the maker of these dollhouses went about getting that extreme precision. There's one story about her wearing this item of clothing for the exact amount of time that she would need for it to look the right amount of lived in, so that she could then cut it up and use the pieces of fabric in the scene. So we're talking an extreme level of detail here. Some might say a forensic level of detail.
Heyo, is that a theme of the episode? So, just drop in a key term in the first 3 minutes. Buzzword.
You spotted the woman who's lying half down the stairs and clearly dead in this diorama. So this dollhouse, although that's not what their maker, Francis Glesnely, called them, this dollhouse is one of 19 or 20, there's like a missing one, called the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. And they were made in the 1940s by Francis Glesnely, who's a really interesting character. And I'm going to tell you a bit about her history and her story now.
Cool.
So these dollhouses, or as she preferred to call them, Nutshell Studies, each depict an unexplained death. Sometimes it's a clearly violent death. There's blood, there's gore. Other times it's unclear whether or not violence has occurred. But in each case, the death is mysterious or unexplained. So I guess, sort of as an opening question, what might the purpose of this kind of object be? Because it feels kind of incongruous, no? Like a miniature or a dollhouse of gory, unexplained deaths.
Yeah, it definitely feels like there's a contradiction here, where dollhouses are things that are usually thought of as pretty and really innocuous and very feminine. You know, they're coded as for female children. And then to throw in the death, like as I was saying, as I was scrolling through that room, you know, it felt pretty straightforward until all of a sudden I saw this woman face down in the staircase. And like I said, it took me a minute. So I guess in terms of what this might be for, I assume that Frances Glesnely was not like a morbidly troubled child who was just like using her dollhouses for playing out murders. But you said, you know, they're nutshell cases for unexplained death. So I assume that she's working with police or with the government maybe in some way to use these objects to solve these unexplained murders. I'm interested to hear how exactly they did that.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting concept to start with.
So I think you've already hit on a lot of things. First of all, it's taking us back to drowning people in the pool and whether or not that actually means you were a troubled child.
Emma means drowning people in the pool in Sims, not just drowning people in the pool, because if as a child you are drowning people in the pool, definitely are troubled in some way.
So you're definitely most of the way there. However, they're not actually used for solving cases, which I think is quite interesting. They're training tools. They're training tools for trainee homicide investigators. And I do want to get back to the stuff about domesticity, about how they're like these feminine coded objects, because I think it's really interesting. But I also want to tell you the history of these objects and how they came to be.
Okay. Are we at all going to talk about like the aestheticization and the kind of putting on a pedestal of police procedures? Like, is this copaganda in terms of like increasing that aestheticization? And you know, like every cop show is like, oh, and I'm a genius because I can like bring together all these ideas. Do these play into that?
I definitely think let's see if we can get there at the end thinking okay. about these as copaganda, because I yeah. do think that they're really interesting objects in terms of, and especially actually what they've become, which is they've become these really cult objects. They were virtually unknown until a few years ago to the general public. And mm-hmm. then there was a series of things that happened, but one of them was that the Smithsonian put on an exhibit of these works. So for the first time, people could actually go and see them in person. And now there's like, you know, when I was doing research for this, there's books, there's podcasts, there's, I think, a documentary. Simon Armitage, the poet, did a Channel 4 documentary that's really interesting. You know, there's a lot of cultural production around these works. And I definitely think but I think it's interesting that you say copaganda, because one of the things that's really interesting about Frances Glesner-Lee is her insider/outsider status within the police force, but above all, her veneration and obsession with the science of forensics, with what is called legal medicine, with this idea that homicide detectives, investigators need to be trained scientifically in how to read a crime scene, how to get at some idea of truth. And she really sees her objects, these objects, as involved in that. So let me tell you a little bit about Frances Glesner-Lee. She's a really interesting figure. She's an heiress, comes from a really wealthy family. She's born in 1878 and dies in 1962, which is a really wild date range. She sort of gets married off to this dude. They have a very like mid relationship. So she's this heiress. She comes from this really wealthy family. And nevertheless, as is typical for her class and gender at the time, she's not allowed to work and not encouraged to work, despite the fact that she's really bright and really obsessed with medicine, and specifically what we would now think of as forensic medicine or legal medicine. They eventually get divorced. And then after they get divorced and after her dad dies, she seems to be a little bit more liberated to pursue some of the interests that she couldn't earlier in life. Although as an important sidebar, as a woman growing up in the late 19th century, she's of course trained in a bunch of different crafts. And she also, when she's 35, builds for her mother this dollhouse miniature of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, complete with working instruments.
That is so cool.
Yeah. And I want to flag that that's not actually a niche or inappropriate or weird pursuit at the time. As we'll get into, dollhouses, in fact, are objects, quote unquote, for adults for like a really long time. I mean, first of all, the concept of childhood itself is basically, as we understand today, is invented in the 19th century. But, the dollhouse originates as, among other things, an upper-class/middle-class display of wealth and a pursuit for women.
So are you saying that making dollhouses, like, as a craft was an acceptable way of spending time for women of that class in that period?
Yeah, it's like, it's not an uncommon hobby. So her neighbor, or like someone in Chicago at the same time as her, Narcissa Niblack Thorne, also,
great name.
Yeah. Made or oversaw, I don't know how it worked exactly, the making of a series of really famous miniature period rooms, which are now at the Art Institute of Chicago. So, you know, it's not uncommon for the sort of class. And in 1898, she meets this man called George Burgess McGrath, who's quite important to her story.
Wait, also, he's quite important for a random piece of American art. Do you know about this?
No.
So he is the man who, the forensics guy, like ballistics and forensics, right?
Yes.
Who ended up providing the evidence to convict Sacco and Vanzetti, yes, who are in one of a very, very famous piece of American art by Ben Shahn from 1931, 1932.
I don't know this work.
So it's this whole series about this murder trial of Sacco and Vanzetti, which was like a very dramatic story. And yeah, the most famous piece by Ben Shahn of Sacco and Vanzetti is them dead in their caskets, open casket funeral, and they're being handed lilies by members of the committee who like helped put them away, which is terrible. Anyway, it's a really interesting case for early forensics. So I love that there's this weird connection. I mean, I don't know if it's relevant, but like as an art historian, that's my way into trials and forensics in America in this period.
It's wild to me that you even know who he is, because I'm doing my research for this and I'm like, blah, blah, blah. Okay, there's this dude. You know, he's the first chair of legal medicine at Harvard, you know.
Niche interests, okay? Like, this is how this happens. It's interesting because I feel like that, for someone who studies American art or is interested in American visual culture, like that is a much more well-known painting. So to have that connection to Frances Glessner Lee is just, it's just an interesting way into her and like the world that she's living in and the fields that are growing up while she's working.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the history of the fields of whether you want to call it legal medicine or forensic science. I think they're slightly different envelopes, you know, they're related, but both are relevant in this case. The 1930s are a really interesting time for forensics. Basically, until this point, police officers, as well as the people who examine a body in the case of an unexplained or sudden death, are not necessarily trained in any particular way. Unfortunately, this continues to be the case in many states in the US today. We're going to talk a little bit about the difference between coroners and medical examiners, but there's several states in which you need far more qualifications and hours of training to become a hairdresser than to become a coroner, which is a politically appointed position, but one that hinges and changes a lot of life and death cases in the legal system relating to murder.
I hate everything that you just said. I agree with it and I know that it's correct. And I just, it makes me, especially as someone who just moved back to the States, to a place that has a very fraught relationship with the police.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and we can talk, the fact that these are in Baltimore, yes, as well is really interesting, which is, you know, having lived here now for a couple of months and learned a bit about the history of the city and the police and how fucked up it is.
Yeah, in the 1920s and 1930s, I mean, yeah, the police force is chaos. There's no routine set of rules about like examining a body and explain death, etc. And the stuff sort of starts to change in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s with people like McGrath, but also this guy called Oscar Heinrich, who's the subject of Kate Winkler Dawson's book, American Sherlock. And I think we will definitely talk about Sherlock Holmes in this episode.
I will also say I don't have a fun art history fact related to that guy. I've never heard of him in my life.
Well, actually, Oscar Heinrich is basically the nation's first unique crime scene investigator. So these things like CSI, you know, the idea of even investigating a crime scene methodically in the first place. And the reason I think her book is titled American Sherlock is because it's these series of ideas associated with fictional detectives, which I think is super interesting, like the arch-rationalist Sherlock Holmes. And it's not a coincidence, I think, that Glessner Lee is herself allegedly a big fan of the Sherlock Holmes books, and she grows up reading them.
Definitely not a coincidence.
No.
That's such an interesting facet of it.
So
I'm just thinking, yeah.
So the reason McGrath is an important figure for her is she's always had this fascination with crime, not only Sherlock Holmes and these fictional crimes, but also true crime. And you know, she collects these manuscripts and medical treatises and sort of articles and police files and a lot of, you know, basically everything she can find about crime, about murder, about the medical study of unexplained deaths. And McGrath really encourages her in these interests. And his thing in the 1920s is only medical examiners should be allowed to examine like the causes of death, that it shouldn't be coroners, which is a political elected office, and not one that requires any sort of formal training. Anyway, so basically in 1931, Lee donates a ton of money to Harvard to help found the Department of Legal Medicine there. And she endows a chair, and that chair is McGrath.
It's also really interesting that this is happening the same year that the Sacco and Vanzetti paintings are made, like right after that big case. So obviously, this is such a moment for exactly this field, which I know is absolutely what you're saying, but such a moment.
Absolutely. Anyway, in 1934, Lee also donates her library of 3,000 books to create the George Burgess McGrath Library of Legal Medicine at Harvard.
Wait, what is she an heiress of? Like, what was there?
Just, I don't know, money. I don't know. Who fucking knows? Probably slavery. Like, you know?
Probably, like a descended from slave owners bullshit.
It's
yeah.
all
cool.
Unethical. So the department finally opens in 1938. It's got these new training tools. It's got basically this forensic training for the first time, you know, training students in the peculiarity of certain wounds, what certain ligature marks or discolorations can teach you about how the person died, stuff like blood splatter, which, as a sidebar, is interesting because it's one of our first flags of stuff that's being treated like a hard science, which is now, you know, disputed or treated as bogus science, or more specifically as needing very framed interpretation to be remotely valid in a court of law.
It just, you know, it helps to show the shifting definitions of science throughout the 20th century, for sure.
And also that this idea that observation is neutral, or that you can read evidence as a route to truth, is a bit suspect, as suggested by the fact that these things that have been upheld as routes to truth for decades are then at some point like thrown out as, you know, of the scientific orthodoxy. Anyway, they look at, you know, you get trained in ballistics, wounds made by different kinds of bullets and powders, entomology, so like how the insect life in a decomposing body, what it says about when it died and how it died.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, really cool.
But you're getting the theme, right? It's like all these different scientific techniques that can be used to determine a cause of death. And that's really important for legal cases, for figuring out how someone died, why they died, what the cause of death might be. Now we're finally at the nutshells. So the nutshells, as I said, they're these 20-ish dioramas. The scale is 1 inch to 1 foot. And basically in the early 1940s, she starts working on these dioramas. And the purpose of them is she becomes, you know, the story goes that she becomes really surprised that a lot of homicide investigators don't know how to read a crime scene. You know, this is still the era where people are just, journalists are walking through a crime scene and picking stuff up, and photographers can just show up, and family members are moving a body, and police are moving a body and putting their fingers in bullet wounds.
So no caution tape and evidence bags. And look, all that stuff you see on CSI. No care at all for destruction of evidence.
So, as makes sense for someone who grew up on the Sherlock Holmes stories, she starts building these dioramas with obsessive detail. One of the things that she does is she puts in all these details that she reads about in case files and stuff that you are meant to read to determine the cause of death of the body in the scene. Now, one thing that took me a while to discover in my research on this, but which I think is super important, is that they don't always, each one doesn't necessarily refer to an exact true crime scene that actually took place. I guess what I'm trying to say is like, there's this real emphasis in her thing on like the pursuit of truth. And it's just interesting to me that it's unclear how much these were actually true crime scenes, even though they're framed that way.
So the starting point is problematic. Yeah, question mark in terms of truth from the outset.
And
that's
evidence.
Really interesting.
But they're still incredibly useful training tools, and indeed they're still used today. And Baltimore, actually, we'll get into this, but also has this room next door called the Scarpetta Room, named after a fictional detective, in which they do full scale reenactments of crime scenes where someone is a volunteer dead body painted with all the specific details of how they died, and the homicide, or I think in that case it's also people training for their medical examiner's license, have to come in and read the scene.
Okay, that is so cool. And did I tell you about my aunt and uncle that I lived with before I moved to Baltimore in DC?
Maybe.
So, okay,
tell me more.
I promise this is relevant. So he trained as an actor, but then his main career was running through reenactments of scenarios, not dissimilar to what you're talking about, to train risk assessment, particularly related to like terrorist attacks or far right attacks or mass shootings and things. So like he has a whole fleet of actors who will go in with campus police. I was acted in a couple of the videos as like the stalked girlfriend of someone who's been, made extreme by the far right. But it's this idea that like walking through these things with real people or objects in the case of Lee, like help the brain to process how to act in the future. Is that kind of the purpose of them?
Yes. And I want to flag that because I want us to get back to it in more depth because I think we both have a lot to say about it. And also from an art history perspective, I think there's gender stuff going on here too, right? In our Sims episode, we were like, why is playing with dolls not serious, but Call of Duty is? And I think in this case as well, why is acting or theater or performance art not serious, you know, or it like a women's or a queer thing and therefore disregardable and just a form of play. And I'm saying that in scare quotes, just a form of acting. But things like crime scene reconstitution is, you know, a scientific tool.
Scientific and macho.
Yes.
Because it's murder and it's usually protecting women because women are overwhelmingly the ones who are getting murdered.
So.
And so, yeah.
So a lot is made of the fact that most of her scenes depict women and domestic settings. I mean, I would add that most murders involve women,
Most murders are involving women.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's necessarily, yeah. So it's really interesting to me also thinking about domesticity and gender and the building of these dioramas that their names are really innocuous. And they often describe the rooms, not the death or the body or so. I'm just going to read you some of the names: attic, barn, blue bedroom, living room, kitchen, pink bathroom, parsonage parlor, red bedroom, striped bedroom, three-room dwelling. So, you know, some of them are leaning more towards like the like three-room dwelling sounds more like a police report, but the pink bathroom or the striped bedroom.
It's about the aesthetics.
Yes.
Or it's about the way that it appears. That's really interesting.
It's interior design. And I do want to think about why Glessna Lee, who had so much money, did all these dioramas herself. I mean, she had the help of a carpenter, but each one of them took, I read something that said that each one took as long and was as expensive to build as a real house at that time.
Wow.
Yeah, $3,000 to $4,000, if you want to know.
Yeah, but, you know. Just like my Sims haunted house cost me £7.50, right?
Yeah.
same thing.
And the reason she creates these, I don't know if I've been clear enough about this yet, is she wants to make these objects to train future homicide investigators in how to look, which, like, you know, buzzer alert for art history and, like, art historical methodologies,
oh,
right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And
close looking, searching, very Sherlock Holmesy.
Yes,
once again.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And she says specifically she makes these nutshells with such overwhelming detail in order to make you stop and see that it could be the smallest detail that turns a case.
Be the cat sitting on the couch, like a detail, like something like that, like the newspaper is fallen next to the armchair kind of thing that I saw
exactly.
In the first image.
Okay. And I want to talk about some of these details because they're wild. So, for instance, each little cigarette, which is like 3 millimeters long or something, actually has tobacco in it, and she lights it and lets it burn to like the exact point where it's meant to have burned.
I love her.
Yeah. She paints under wash basins. She paints like lime scale and like paints the floorboards to be discolored in a specific way. She specifically, there's details that don't matter, right? So like, for instance, there's a story about how one of the rocking chairs, she wanted it to be weighted to rock back and forth at the exact same rate or frequency as the real one, even though no one's ever going to push it.
But it's like this overabundance of detail.
Yes.
That makes it a scientific dollhouse and therefore takes it out of the realm of being like something that a kid plays with,
well,
to being something used for forensics and for science.
Although,
right?
Of course, dollhouses and miniatures also themselves are obsessed with that level of detail. But
that's
true. I guess it's the relationship between that detail and the alleged truth that matters.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
dollhouses always have a profusion of detail, but it's not always necessarily important that the cigarette in the dollhouse is placed 3.2 millimeters away from the body, which will help you determine that it was actually not being smoked when the person fell.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay.
The magazines and newspapers you see are exact facsimile, you know, using these really new tools, front and back page of the exact newspapers from the right day that were meant to be there at the time. The bodies, which are filled with BB shot and cotton to give them the heft of a corpse, are very specifically painted with ligature marks, with the discoloration that's meant to show carbon monoxide poisoning, with striations on the cheek that suggest where someone was hit, with blood spatter on the walls, darker blood closer to the body, this incredible detail. And part of it has to also do with the fragmentary nature of evidence itself, right? And that profusion of detail that you latch onto, I think, is really important, because one of the things that's really interesting, a tension between these dioramas or these dollhouses, these created, fabricated things, and let's say a photograph of a crime scene, is that do you remember in the Midsummer episode, we talked about how things matter because every detail in a film is deliberately placed there. You know that because it's staged, as opposed to, say, a documentary photograph. Well, one of the things she's trying to train these homicide investigators to look for, and she basically ends up giving each one like 90 minutes. They have a magnifying glass and a flashlight, and then they have to like present the case and say how the person died, make an argument for it. But one of the things she's trying to get them to look for, or one of the things she's trying to get them to understand, is that every detail is significant in that you have to notice it, but not every detail is necessarily relevant in real life to understanding a case. And that's one of the most difficult things about homicide and crime scene investigation.
Right. But then she is loading certain objects with a lot of meaning, correct?
Well, she's loading every
object. And she's creating objects. Sorry, yes. So she's loading objects with a lot of meaning, and she's creating objects that themselves have a lot of meaning within these cases.
Yes.
But this is really interesting because, so a book I just read, it's a new book by David Houston Jones on visual culture and the forensic. He kind of does the intersection of those two fields, visual culture and the forensic, taking it from the forensic body to the forensic landscape, to the computer, to language, to the face. That's just like how the book is structured. But one of the through lines between the, or within the book, is this idea of where evidence comes from within forensics, and how, you know, he's looking at objects, he's looking at visual culture, so images, objects, material culture, etc. And he's saying that there, you know, overall is some worry that this focus on objects and the evidentiary quality of them is undermining or taking away from human speech and testimony as evidence, like that. You know, objects are infallible because we've, through the growing up of the field of forensics, they've become infallible and they become so important. So therefore, human testimony is being undermined because humans are fallible and memory is fallible, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, he complicates it by saying, yeah, but things can't be totally divorced from the human worlds in which they're made and the human intersections that they have. You know, these are still cigarettes that have been smoked by people, placed by people, like they're within the domestic sphere, et cetera. So they still don't have their own language that is totally based in evidentiary objective fact that is divorced from the human. So this whole dichotomy between the two is kind of false.
Well,
and it's really interesting that we're looking at, it's just really interesting. And I haven't quite figured out exactly what I think about it, but I think that distinction is fascinating.
And of course, because as is one of our favorite themes on this podcast, science isn't neutral and objective. The human observer is not neutral and objective. So the idea that we can even read objects in some quote unquote objective way, and that reading an object is less fallible than listening to a person reading a room in more ways than one, is wild. But it's one of the founding myths, and I'm going to bring up the word virtues and virtue epistemes of science and of scientific objectivity.
No, absolutely. And there's a phrase that I don't actually know exactly what it means.
Go for it.
But I think it applies here, which is object-oriented ontology as like a way of orienting.
I was hoping we'd never get here because I also don't really know what object-oriented ontology is, but I do know that I saw on Twitter that it's now been eclipsed by what I also don't understand, but is called the material turn.
Well, the material turn makes more sense to me and sounds less gatekeeping than object-oriented ontology. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
But anyway, are we doing object-oriented ontology? Oh, my God.
Is this, you know, the butterfly meme? Is this object-oriented ontology?
Christine and Emma talking about murder?
But I do want to, so obviously the theme of this podcast is art, science, and the macabre. And I think that this case of these, like, this obsessive, careful, loving creation of these dollhouses, both dollhouses and craft being women's work, in the service of this masculine, rational, scientific enterprise to help all male homicide investigator students determine how to read truth is fascinating and a major theme.
Definitely. I also, is there something going back to what we were saying about, you know, most of these murders being women? Is there an argument to be made of these objects as feminist objects that are, like, I don't know, that are, you know, using these female coded methods and materials to then, oh, but you said that they're not actually solving murders. So I was thinking, like,
well, it's training
if they're
them.
Being used. Yeah, it's training them to solve murders. But I was thinking, like, oh, maybe these are feminist objects that are then helping to liberate women from the violence and oppression of men who are killing them. Is that, I don't know.
Well, there's a few, I don't know.
But putting it out there.
No, definitely, because I think there's a few routes we can take this, which is really interesting. The one is Glasnier as a figure, because there's class stuff going on there as well as gender stuff. So she ends up getting made an honorary, the first honorary police chief who's a woman, I think, or something like that, because she leads these seminars for these homicide investigator students. And this is, by the way, 25 years before women police officers are allowed to drive around in their own cop car, you know?
How fun.
Yeah. However, she occupies a really interesting status that also, I think, has something to do with the nature of evidence itself and the nature of these dollhouses themselves, between inside and outside, public and private. And part of the reason she's able to do that is because she's a wealthy heiress.
This is so weird. I know there are a lot of differences here, but this is really parallel to my main research project, like my PhD / my book, where I argue that the surgical artist that I'm working on, because she was wealthy and had connections into, like, worlds of medicine and art, was able to, as a surgical artist, be inside, like, the medical realm, but also not as a woman being able to work in it in other ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Very strange. Anyway, yeah, it's, I'm sure it's a story in so many fields, but I was like, oh my God, that's exactly the story of the artist that I work on.
And you see, one of the things I find really interesting in the telling of the story of Lee is you see pretty much, there are some nuanced exceptions, but pretty much two approaches, which mirror some of my pet peeves about approaches to women artists, right? Or just women in history. One is like, look at this girl boss. She's slaying her way into the police force. We love not only cops, but also women, you know.
Good for her. But yeah, good for her for still winning.
You know, and stuff propping up the canon, you know, in a way, and stuff that's like, she's the mother of forensic science and she's the first person to do forensic science, ignoring the fact that, frankly, in many ways, what we now consider forensic science was practiced by the Chinese in 12 something something, you know.
So white feminism, basically.
Yeah. And also, you know, I don't know if this is necessarily the episode where once again we need to get into the racist history of forensics, like, but just to give a quick example, fingerprint technology comes from policing practices in imperial India, where colonial oppressors fingerprint the indigenous people, the locals, because they, quote unquote, can't read and write, and they, like, can't tell them, the white people can't tell them apart. And then that gets taken up and used by Francis Galton, who argues that we can read fingerprints, and then by the Metropolitan Police Force in London to identify criminals. So you can't extricate the history of policing from the history of racism and from histories of class. Anyway.
No, for sure. I think that's a really good way of tying it into this topic, sure.
And I think I said there were two things. I said there's two ways that she gets talked about, right? So the one is like, yay, she's this girl boss. And then the other one, which is also yikes, is people being like, this busybody amateur weaseling her way into the police force where she had no right being, you know, and being like, oh, this amateur. But it's like, clearly, by developing this dollhouse, these scenarios, these dioramas, I mean, they're clearly a valuable tool because they're still being used today to train people, because, and maybe this is the big takeaway for me of this episode, learning how to look, teaching people how to look, teaching people how to read evidence, and I mean that in the broadest possible sense, to read details, to read symbols, is a really important tool. And it's one that something like art history, which is gendered feminine, teaches us, but that we love to denigrate. Whereas when, you know, a bunch of cops do it, it's like serious science and really important.
You should put this into your teaching statement for any and all future job apps. This is why art history is important. Teaching how to look. It's very true. And definitely I was, you know, when I was thinking about this episode, I was like, that's definitely a theme. The relationship between visual analysis, close looking, and crime scenes, for sure. But I just wanted to go back to what you said about, you know, the second way that Lee is talked about, and just like the very obvious ways that amateur and busybody are both coded like unrelentingly feminine,
yes,
and wealthy, and like middle-aged woman just like having nothing, like having no reason to be there, which it just enrages me. Yeah.
Not a middle-aged woman, a grandma. She's in her 60s, yeah, and a literal grandmother, I think, when she first makes these nutshells.
And then you think about the fact that she's knitting little cats and, like, you know, putting together these really very domestic scenes. And you can see how assholes could really, like, code this in a really upsetting or kind of not productive way. And that totally undermines, as you said, the use and the purpose of these that are still being used to train people. Let's get to play.
Yes.
That's a concept.
What do you want to say about play?
Well, I'm just thinking about, like, we didn't really talk about this in the Sims episode, but play is a really useful analytical and psychological tool that a lot of famous child psychologists have used. You know, like D.W. Winnicott, Melanie Klein, Anna Freud, they all kind of have different ways of thinking through the purpose of play, but like having it as a productive action, which I think is what we're kind of seeing with these, you know, if we're thinking of the nutshells as dollhouses, as like things that have these echoes of play. I think maybe the most useful framing of play, like as a productive exercise, would be Winnicott's, which is his idea, which is from his 1971 piece, Playing in Reality, the idea that play helps to build cognition and emotional development, which helps you reach the quote unquote true self, which once again,
yeah,
we're getting to evidence, objectivity, and truth. You know, like Melanie Klein also thinks of play as therapeutic, which I'm not sure relates as much, but I don't know. What do you think about like the way that play is framed within these objects? If we're thinking about them as dollhouses, you know?
So I have a lot of thoughts about this. It's really interesting because when we think about play, at least I found in my research for this episode, and the value of play, firstly, what often comes up is, as you mentioned, these child psychologists and, you know, this idea that goes back to, let's say, Freud or...
Definitely back to Freud.
About... yeah, what you're working through, and often trauma being one of the things you're working through, or certain dynamics. But then there's this really beautiful social history that maps onto that in a really interesting way. And I read this really fascinating book chapter by Mary Flanagan in her book Critical Play, which is actually about game design. But she has a chapter on playing house, and she actually does mention Lee at the end of this chapter, which is interesting. But
that's really cool. That's really, really cool.
Yeah. She gives this fascinating... so basically in her analysis, she's really interested in this thing called critical play. And what that means is that play can create a liminal period for the play participants. And I think one thing I was sort of, you know, in the Sims episode, I talked a lot about capitalism, and I was really focused on that, and, you know, the idea of whether the game could disrupt capitalism. And I wasn't really thinking about the other aspects of what play can do, which she was talking about, but which I think you were getting at in that episode a bit more, which is it can allow you to work through things, right? And I think so. When she's talking about the history of dollhouses in particular, I think there's a really interesting way to see this. So she talks about how for people like Foucault, for a lot of scholars, I mean, actually, you know, I don't know if Foucault talks about dollhouses in particular, but he does, I think, talk about houses and, you know, what goes on within the home, that the domestic space is a place where, you know, you play out and reify these certain political hegemonies, right? That where certain ideas about the correct gender roles and those sorts of ideologies get enforced. And one of the conventional readings of dollhouses, right, especially by the 19th century, when they do become associated with kids, because as I mentioned, actually for a really long history before then, there was, you know, simply beautiful objects and markers of class status, in fact. But when they do start getting used by kids, there's this idea that, you know, you're giving them the dollhouse so that they can learn how to be a mommy, because one day they will have to be a mommy and marry a daddy. But one of the things she points out is there's all these social histories and then reactive capitalisms that go with it about how even Victorian girl children were like, absolutely not, and did the equivalents of drowning their Sims in the pool.
Or if you were me and my cousins, like cutting the hair, you know, the Barbies with the really, really long hair that you like buzz it off, basically. But anyway, so that's really interesting that there is a longer social history of that. That does complicate this idea that dollhouses were just like, well, I just completely lost my
chain of thought. I mean, it complicates a couple of things. One of the things it complicates is the idea that there's something weird about these macabre dollhouses that Lee makes, you know, which I think that's like people, lot of the media around this is like, how weird to have a dollhouse that's macabre. And it's like, clearly you didn't play with dolls, because as you just said, like cutting off their hair, making them do awful things is like par for the course. And what I guess the child psychology thing is like whether or not that means that there's something quote unquote wrong with, or like,
yeah,
that needs to be healed in the child. And I think that's sort of slightly beside the point. But I just want to read some quotes from the Flanagan, because I think they're really useful. So she says, there is evidence that girls in particular were resistant to, even critical of, the social roles being ascribed through doll play. Even in everyday play, 19th century girls met the emphasis on normative domestic behavior of women with subversive resistance. While adults saw playing with dolls as useful for social feminization, some children would use the dolls for purposes distinctly different than their intended use. Rather than focus on mothering and household management skills, players often opted to play out scenes of strife, family fights, incidents that broke strict social etiquette, and illness. And then she adds, in scenes rather resembling television crime dramas, these play sessions might result in punishment, dismemberment, or death of a doll.
That makes so much sense to me. And I love that you read this. And like, I know we sound like a broken record here, but it does really relate to a lot of the conversations that we had in the last episode about The Sims.
Yeah.
Like, the purposes here are not that dissimilar between dollhouses and Sims, and it shows you how not out of the norm Lee's work is, which is so cool.
And specifically, I think what Flanagan's reading of Lee's work, so Flanagan calls all these sorts of things that these girls are doing critical play. And she says critical play basically involves three kinds of actions: unplaying, redressing or reskinning, and rewriting. So unplaying is doing what's forbidden, so like killing your dolls. Reskinning or redressing is dressing the dolls for subversive roles. So I think that can probably count like cutting off the hair, or like making them wear funeral gear because they're going to visit the doll you just killed.
Or putting like, or cross-dressing.
Yes. Absolutely.
Switching the genders of the clothes. Yeah, for sure.
And then rewriting. So like, there was this whole subgenre of basically, once people started realizing children were using dolls this way, it created this whole second wave of commercialized stuff. So you could buy like a little coffin for your doll. And also they started to produce these books supposedly written by dolls, so speaking in the doll's voice.
Like American Girl dolls.
Yes.
Because they have their whole narratives alongside them. Yeah.
And her reading of Lee, which I'm actually not sure I entirely agree with, but it's interesting, says that Lee enacted all three types of those critical play. She reskins the dollhouse to make it a scene of a macabre crime. She unplays conventional police work by doing stuff, you know, by doing stuff that's inappropriate for dolls to do. And she says she like rewrote her role and the importance of doll playing. I'm not sure I buy that, because also one of the things I think it's important to be clear about is these houses were not intended for play. And that doesn't mean that we can't talk about these themes, but I think it's really important that what Lee wanted you to do was basically enter into the space as a criminal investigator. And that's why earlier I said this idea of being dropped into them is almost the ideal form of how you're meant to experience them. Not touch, because remember, homicide investigators don't touch and don't play.
That's what I was thinking while we were talking. I was like, play is more like an adjacent theme within these, because they do resemble dollhouses, but they are meant for more of like reenactment, right?
Yes. And I think that the theme of domesticity is still important, because she is depicting domestic scenes. And I've just realized we haven't actually looked at that many. So maybe in a second we could look at
some
more. But, you know, the dark domesticity in them is interesting. And I really want to talk about this idea of reconstruction and reenactment, because if you're right, that is where the play is happening. Is the play is like the homicide investigators putting themselves into the shoes of the actual homicide investigator of that scene.
Of course. And then you're thinking about the exact perspective that you're inhabiting within yes. the room, and like, what role are you playing? Are you kind of in a way playing the role of the killer, and you're like trying to enter their world? Is that what's the reenactment that's trying to happen? And that again relates to the Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes stories, because, you know, especially like in the TV and film adaptations of Sherlock Holmes, you know, they make such a big deal of the mind palace and yes. like Sherlock Holmes going into this almost alternate plane, virtual reality. And so the fact that she is taking these stories from her childhood that allowed her to play as a child into her work that is adjacent to play, I think is really interesting.
And I have two ideas going off of this. One of them is just an anecdote or little fact, which is that she actually inserted details from her own life into these scenes sometimes, which I think is fascinating. So there's this obsession with getting the details all right. But then the picture in the scene will be of her childhood mansion.
Yeah. See, once again, we have that weird elision of truth and objectivity yeah. and evidence here,
but
where like that's the purpose, but it's not actually there at the beginning or at all.
And then the other thing is something we sort of keep dancing around, I think, which is the role of the scientific observation in these cases, right? Because the thing about a memory palace or VR or any of these other things is, sure, on the one hand, they're trying to teach you how to put yourself into, you know, they're training tools, right? Just like the Scarpetta room, which I mentioned, is also here, where, you know, you train to actually look at a body. And as you mentioned, your uncle, and you mentioned all these other ways of doing reenactments that are clearly very valuable as training. But I think like a mind palace is also a fabrication, right? And I think this thing of interpretation and the role of interpretation here is really interesting. And I really think it's one of the things that art history has to teach things like scientific investigation, right? It's like, I think she got so close by being like, you have to learn how to read things. She also gave them, she was like, you should read clockwise, like literally giving them like art historical ekphrasis, visual analysis techniques for how to take in all the detail in a crime scene. But then
I love that so much. I love that so much.
But then I'm not entirely clear on whether there's, how much emphasis is then being put on what art historians do next, which is interpret, right? So like even in a Fragonard painting where every detail, every symbol is so freighted with meaning, and you're meant to be able to read the painting, or Pre-Raphaelite works, which by the way, also come from Ruskin and debates in the history of science and important stuff about how detail is a route, not only to the real and to truth, but to an almost divine sense of, you know, reality of this underlying true essence. But as art historians, you do that work of reading the painting, and then you also offer an analysis. And I just want to say, like, as I'm talking, I am remembering that actually in some cases she did include other things like witness statements as additional evidence, but the primary purpose is teaching them how to look. And I think there is a problematics there of the idea that looking is somehow an objective, scientific, neutral skill.
And it's placing it as, it is placing the visual as the most important sense.
Yes.
You know, it's the primacy of the visual, which is also something definitely in medicine. So it's interesting that in like forensic medicine and forensic science, that's being privileged. Really interesting that you brought up, you know, these Pre-Raphaelite and Rococo paintings. I'm wondering, can we kind of, the forensic is also a really big theme in contemporary art. Can we kind of think about the role that it has there?
Yeah, for sure. Because one of the things, I think we might go there, but one of the things I wanted to point out is we've danced around the fact that one of the differences even between the paintings I just described in these works is space and dimensionality. And like, you know, I'm sure you have things to say about forensic photography, for instance, which is a,
yes,
you know, different form. But yeah, what...
Oh, for sure. I mean, when you were thinking about the domestic, I was thinking about, you know, you've got those four walls. And, you know, when you dropped me into that VR room, I was thinking a lot about domestic space and the role that place has with forensic imagery and forensic art. And one thing that I thought was really interesting in the visual culture in the forensic book is that David Houston Jones specifically talked about how he was saying that professional forensics as a field has always been and continues to be linked with the rise of photography.
Mm.
and its evidentiary and objective promise, like this, you know, this pinnacle of objectivity that we're, that both forensics and photography are searching for through the late 19th and early 20th centuries, yes. Right? And so there are a slew, not to make them sound like not individual, but there are a slew of like contemporary photographers, contemporary artists who are working with the forensic because the themes and the theory of the forensic intersect with the themes and the theory of photography so well. And so one of those people is Angela Strassheim, who I think you'll find really interesting. Do you know about her work?
No.
Okay. So she looks at what she calls, either she calls them this or David Houston Jones calls them this, but she looks at tainted places and they're tainted by this specter of the invisible, the forensic, and tainted by murder, right? So she was trained as a forensic photographer first and has this photography series from the early 2000s, like 2009-ish, called Evidence. And she focuses on the domestic and on place. She takes these really innocuous looking photographs of houses in which murders took place. And you talked about captions before, or not captions, but the titles of Lee's works being like pink bedroom, yeah, or three bedroom house or whatever. Strassheim does the same thing with the title of this piece that you're looking at right now, Emma. It's an innocuous white house with a pink door, suburbia. And the title is Evidence, Kitchen Knife 2.
That's so,
so she'll do the weapon or Evidence, Pistol 1. And then she goes in, not inside the same house. So it's kind of the same thing that you were talking about with Lee, where like there are these slippages between the stories that are quite different. She doesn't necessarily always get into the inside of the house that she photographs from the outside. You know, it's not like they're pairs.
Well, yes, there's aspects of almost fiction or like recreation or reconstruction going on in the service of documentation.
Absolutely, where you kind of pair these images together. So she's got the outside of these really innocuous, boring looking suburban houses, and then evidence inside different houses in which murders have taken place. And she uses something called Blue Star Forensic, which is a blood visualizing agent that illuminates the proteins with inside the blood. And so what she does is she then uses that within the house and then takes photographs of when the proteins in the blood is illuminated. So it's a very forensic looking photograph being used as contemporary art.
And it's, there's a few things. I mean, with the, you know, like a luminol, which, or I don't know what you called it, but luminol.
Blue Star Forensic. Yeah. Yeah. It illuminates the protein. Yeah.
Yeah. It also gives these images this spectral quality. And I think a lot, another thing that we sort of danced around in our Sims episode and didn't get to was the haunted house and the importance of the house as like a site where these psychodramas play out. I mean, I think there's a reason why, you know, first of all, the sheer horror of a murder occurring in your domestic space, it feels like the biggest horror possible. And yet most women are murdered by their intimate partners, right? That it is the reality of the situation. And it's really interesting to me that not only do the nutshells themselves feel really creepy for all of these Freud, uncanny, you know, dollhouse reasons, but even these contemporary photos you're showing me, they feel creepy for a different reason, which is almost, there's this haunting aesthetic of the glowing luminol of the, you know, this glowing substance, as well as a house, a site where completely violent action is implied and yet absent.
Which, definitely. And I think just another way of saying what you're saying is that like Lee's work, maybe in a more toned down way, but Strassheim's work definitely is just bringing to the forefront the horror of the domestic for so many women.
Yes.
Like within this space and making visible the invisible, like ghosts and fears and traumas that inhabit these spaces for so many women.
Which, though hopefully they didn't know that themselves, those Victorian girls were also probably playing out and preparing themselves for, right? One of the things,
definitely.
One of the things that's really interesting to me was I came across that, now that you're making this connection, I forgot about it, but Richard B. Woodward writes this introduction to, basically there's this photo book on the nutshells, and he says that Lee herself seems to have anticipated a school of postmodern photography by creating environments where grim realism and childish whimsy collide.
That is so perfect.
Yes.
Because a lot of Strassheim's other works are very childhood whimsy, but with the underlay of fear and trauma within the family. The Left Behind series is about children and the rapture. Her work does have this whimsy and fear and everything you just said. Hold on, let me find the one that I'm thinking of.
Oh my God.
This one I love. It's a little girl playing with dolls with angel wings. So it's supposed to be making you think of like morality and fear and the rapture within the domestic space. And you've got this little girl who's obviously very studious and like doing everything that she's supposed to be doing. She's playing with her horses. She's playing with her dolls. And then you've got another child hiding under the bed, like in abject fear.
I didn't see that. Right.
Yeah. So I think like there are these themes within Strossheim's work that relate back to the forensic and the fear of the domestic, especially as it's gendered, that then relate back to Lee. So going back to place and space and the domestic, I also find it really interesting that a lot of contemporary artists, contemporary photographers take the fear and trauma of murder out of the home, like into open spaces. We were talking about that in our Midsommar episode about like how so often fear is concentrated within a haunted house. And one of the really interesting things about Midsommar is that it's like open,
yeah,
and it's nature. And there are two photographers in particular, Stephen Kalmers and Paul Seawright. Paul Seawright documented the sectarian attacks during the 1970s in Belfast. And once again, the use of captions, you know, they're very innocuous looking. The photograph that we're looking at now says Thursday, 14th December, 1972. And he very strategically takes out any reference to Protestant or Catholic in terms of victim or killer. So he photographs these locations of where murders happened during sectarian violence or where the bodies were found. My favorite of his is one, speaking of children and speaking of play, where the photograph is taken from the perspective of being at the top of a children's playground slide. And it says, late last night, a 28-year-old man disappeared from a pub. It wasn't until this morning that his body was found abandoned in a quiet park on the coast. And actually, just thinking about it now, I think it's interesting that Strossheim focuses on interiors and domestic spaces. She's a woman. And then the two photographers that I'm talking about who are photographing outdoor spaces are both men.
Well, one thing
interpret that as you will.
Well, one thing I want to jump in on is also a major difference between these two things is one of them is interested in, I'm guessing, in domestic violence, intimate partner violence, whereas the other one is dealing with political, you said sectarian murders, right? So the political takes place in the public sphere. And
for sure.
And
is photographed by men.
Exactly. No, and the personal takes place in the domestic sphere. I mean, it's falling along these sort of take-up lines. But one thing I do think is really, I think this gets to something really interesting about the nature of evidence, and especially in the hands of someone like Lee, who's an amateur, which is evidence is this fascinating category where reading evidence in a crime scene is often reading the most intimate details of someone's life and their last moments. And
their bodies. And reading the most intimate details of their bodies,
absolutely,
too.
And I remember reading this quote somewhere that was saying that it was a reminder that legal photography is primarily a photography of interiors, right? That the evidence that gets pulled up in a crime scene is so often the photograph of the inside of people's houses. I think it was Alexis Lussier. And, you know, there's this argument that, you know, the categories of privacy or intimacy are themselves sort of these evidentiary categories. And if you think about the afterlives of evidence, one of the readings I did for this is by Catherine Biber in her book In Crime's Archive. And one of the things she's talking about is the afterlife of evidence. And, you know, thinking about Lee creating these scenes for people to study, these like sites of evidence, which also she's basing on police notes. She went on ride-alongs in police cars and stuff. And I think Biber also talks about evidence in the courtroom, and then also how amateur sleuths become obsessed with this evidence after the fact. And then also there's stuff like, you know, the rise of popular consumption of true crime. And
that is so funny. I also looked into Biber's work and I literally had written down the cultural afterlife of criminal evidence in my notes because I wanted to think about exactly what you're saying about this idea of privacy and obsession with the victims and or the killers. And just to add to the Paul Seawright conversation, another photographer, Stephen Kalmers, he took photographs kind of adjacent to Seawright's where it was the places where serial killers dumped the bodies. Mm. And his argument was, and you know, they look really innocuous now, His argument for doing that is that he wanted to focus the story to the victims, like focus the story on the victims rather than the killers, which I don't think those photographs actually do.
Yeah.
Because it's still like this idea of, I mean, it's not telling anyone's story.
No, it reminds me of our discussion of who's the edgelord photographer, Andreas Serrano. Oh.
Yes.
And his photos of bodies in the morgue.
Exactly. Trying to frame it in this way that doesn't quite work ethically for me. And I think that's one of the questions that Biber brings up, is about the ethical implications of looking at these forensic objects that are the cultural afterlife of these crimes. And it's really interesting that sometimes these photographs by people like Strassheim, Seawright, and Kalmers are called after photographs. Yes. You know, so it's this idea that it's, yeah, the afterlives of crime. And what are we doing by looking at these things in the first place? Well, I don't know. I think there's kind of an ethical, I mean, same, a lot of people have ethical questions about true crime podcasts and everything too. So,
but there's also, you know, I think there's two things here for me. There's, you know, Lee's own voyeurism. And even if it's being put to, let's say, a good cause, which is trying to train people to read the cause of death. And as she said, you know, get justice for the guilty and for the innocent alike, there's this aspect where this upper class, you know, heiress, wealthy woman is making these, you know, arguably like fetishizing depictions of the sordid interiors of these middle and working class homes. And there was another thing you said that I think is really interesting and relevant, which is that what a crime does and what is then documented by forensic photography, crime scene photography, crime scene investigation, the nutshell dioramas is it makes, you said, you know, he was photographing innocuous, these sites that seem innocuous, but crime and something gaining the status of evidence makes the innocuous relevant. I was going to say makes the innocuous cuous. What's the opposite of innocuous?
Makes it innocuous.
Makes it innocuous. Yeah. And I think that that's so interesting because it also reminds me of what we were talking about in Midsommar and Thing Theory, and how a lot of art that is not documentary or that is constructed as art, you know, as an art historian, you're trained to look for those things, to read the details, to read the symbols in a Fragonard painting, for the Victorian audiences to read, you know, a William Holman Hunt painting for every symbolic detail, everything that has been carefully placed there in Lee's nutshells, every folded edge of a magazine. And one of the things that's fascinating about both these scenes and the nature of crime scene investigation and reading evidence is that evidence, you know, detail is both the thing where the clue, the answer might lie, and it's also the thing that might throw you off completely.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Yeah, that's a really good point. But it's interesting. It's this idea, you know, with close reading within literature, with visual analysis and art history, it's this idea of knowledge through description and knowledge through close looking and close reading. That's just really, you know, it's implicit in these details, which I think is really interesting.
Well, I think there's a way to tie that back to some of the other arts we've been talking about in this episode so far, and maybe a nice way to end. One of them is Sherlock Holmes and this fantasy of those books that you can read the tiniest details and put all these clues together and thereby sort of objectively solve the case because you're a better observer and a more nuanced interpreter than other people. But it also reminds me of this. So I mentioned earlier that the poet Simon Armitage did a Channel 4 documentary on the nutshells, and he actually wrote three poems that are a response to the nutshells, which are fascinating. But one of the things he said that I think is really, really interesting is that the nutshells themselves, for their details, their miniature sizes, the framing and the narratives, are poems. It's got to do with this fragmentary, the necessarily fragmentary nature of evidence. And for some of these scenes, you know, some of them have solutions, supposedly, Lee's scenes, that have to be kept secret because obviously students are still expected to, you know, analyze the cases. But some do not have solutions. And that fragmentary nature of trying to piece together the detail or trying to tell a story through these fragmented details, I do see the analogy to poetry where there's this holding back and the telling of the story through these little details. Yeah.
Tying it back to poetry then ties it back to literature and like this long-standing history of art and literature aestheticizing and making entertainment murder and suicide. And it's just like, whether Lee is playing into that or not.
Yeah, and also like whether that's a problem. Because as we've been saying about play and about, I mean, art making, and, you know, I think, I don't want to misrepresent her because I skimmed the book really fast, but I think one of Flanagan's points is that critical play is always a form of art making, if I understood correctly, but that it is how we process the world. Like, I do see how it's problematic in that sense of, like, these are real people and they had real lives, but also the fictionalizing, the aestheticizing, those aren't necessarily inherently trivializing things. And I actually think that that's kind of one of the weird lessons of The Nutshells, right? Like, I don't think they trivialize murder. In many ways, they're doing something about it.
I agree with you. And I think it's just like the wider field of this type of visual culture, the, as we said, the cultural afterlives of evidence and murder. I think the wider field has to have a more critical, ethical framework put onto it. But I think that Lee's are something different.
Well, maybe that's a good place to end.
Thank you so much for listening to our episode. Really hope you enjoyed it. We had so much fun recording it. Here's where I insert the cliche about rating, reviewing, and subscribing. And please send this episode to any friends who are interested in true crime, art history, etc.
Especially if they write for a major newspaper who can review us.
Exactly. Send it to all your journalist friends and culture writer friends. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you, as always, to C.S. Merkling for audio post-production and to the Association for Art History for some funding for this season as well. Thanks so much.
Goodbye.
Bye.